This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
The night may be long and the dark may be deep, but the answers are there to be found. Whether it's the normal, the abnormal, or the paranormal, you're in the right place. Let's go beyond reality.
Good evening, good morning, welcome. It's Beyond Reality Radio. I'm your host, JV Johnson. Thanks for being here with me tonight. Terrific show for you tonight from the UK. David Moore will be joining us. David is an author. He's got a new book out on the psychology behind the UFO phenomenon. It's called Evolutionary Metaphors, and we'll be bringing him in just into the show in just a little bit. Just looking ahead a little bit, on Thursday, tomorrow night's program, it should be, there's a little bit of a question mark here because we're trying to shuffle some things around, but at this point, scheduled for the program is Scarlett Ravenswood. Scarlett is a tarot card reader and a business coach. She'll be talking about paganism and divination. And then as we skip ahead to Monday, because Friday is a best of program, Del Bigtree will be here. He is an investigative journalist, and he's a CEO of the Informed Consent Action Network, which discusses his work around vaccines and the pharmaceutical industry and what he calls pharmaceutical tyranny. We've been wanting to talk about vaccines and the controversy surrounding them for a long time. So this will be a start of that discussion. Tuesday, Ken Honda will be here. He's the author of a book called Happy Money. He'll be showing people how to create a life of abundance by changing their relationship with money. I have one relationship with money. I like it, and I want more of it. That's my theory. Maybe he'll teach me that I'm wrong. And then just looking ahead to Wednesday, Graham Phillips, a historical investigator and author, will be back with us. He's been on before. We'll be talking about Stonehenge and the fact that it was used as an ancient healing sanctuary and a calendar. So a lot of great programs coming up. And I've got to apologize to you right now because my producer, Orion, came in last night to do the show. And, of course, I had just gotten back from Scarecon. And he was sick. He's coughing all over the board and the microphones and everything. And I think I've caught a touch of what producer Orion brought into the studio last night, which is a little bit disappointing because I got to head out for Pittsburgh tomorrow for a show down there. Yeah, I'm going to Living Dead Weekend in Monroeville, Pennsylvania, right outside of Pittsburgh. And it's a celebration of a lot of George Romero stuff, a lot of his films and his work, including Creepshow. So that'll be a good time this weekend. Anyway, a lot of stuff ahead, and we're going to be beginning our discussion with David Moore in just a few moments. I've got tea here that's going to help the night along, and I should be hopefully all better by tomorrow by the time I get in the car to head to Pittsburgh. All right, it's Beyond Reality Radio. We've got a great show ahead. Don't go away.
Did you know that online retailers like Amazon have constant deals that can save you money on the things you buy every day? It's no joke. Save 40%, 50%, even 80% on great products. And all you have to do is know about them. Noodle Shark is the way to be alerted when something good is coming your way. Noodle Shark is the social media page that lists great deals that not only save you money, but give you the deals before anyone else has them. All you have to do is find Noodle Shark on Facebook. Search it as The Noodle Shark. That's The Noodle Shark, because you deserve to save too. Become a shark and save.
Telephone number for later in the show is 844-687-7669. We'd love to have your comments and your questions and have you join our discussion. Our guest tonight, David Moore from the UK. David is an author. He's got a new book out. It's called Evolutionary Metaphors. His website is ritualinthedark.wordpress.com if you want to get more information about his work. David, welcome to Beyond Reality Radio. It's an honor to have you here tonight.
It's great to be on the show, JB.
So the book is kind of brand new, isn't it? Just out a couple of weeks.
Yes, it was out on the 1st of June in the U.S.
And the first thing I have to ask you is this title. What are we talking about here? The title is Evolutionary Metaphors, UFOs, New Existentialism, and the Future Paradigm. What are we talking about here?
Evolutionary Metaphors was the title that came to me when I was thinking about the UFO phenomena. And I think it seemed to capture the whole experience. When when you start to read a lot of the books on ufology, you start to come away with a completely evolutionary and groundbreaking new appreciation for reality. So I called it evolutionary metaphors to bring the symbol of the UFO and what it brings to us when we think about it, and the progression of the evolutionary aspect of it.
I find it very interesting when I talk to folks who have researched and done a lot of work in ufology, and I always find there's a really interesting story that started it all for them. What's your story? How did this begin for you?
It all began in 2008 of February when me and my friends, and we were all about in our early 20s at the time, I was about 22, and we went up to this woodland for a little fire that we often did because we lived in a village just outside of the city of Wolverhampton. So there was often not much to do. So we'd go up to this woodland, and this night, which was the 10th of February, it was no different to any other time we went. And we sat down and we started this fire up, and I decided to scout out, and there was a fallen tree which was pushing down some of the other trees in the area, so you could see into the distance and see the horizon in the over another village called Kimver. And as I sat down on this fallen tree and looked out, there was this small contraction of white light. And at first I thought it was just a car headlight coming up over a hill. But I kept my eye on it because it didn't seem to strike me as a car in the first place. So I just kept an eye on it and then realized that it was much closer than it could have been any car or aircraft. And I waited for it to turn around because, you know, when you see a light and it turns, you can see the light glare off into the distance. Well, this was constantly focused on us. So it was getting increasingly closer. So I kept my eye on it, and then it began to creep ever closer. And it was absolutely silent. And I called my friends over and we were looking at it, and we just waited for it to arrive in complete silence. And we all wondered what it was. And then it flew over the canopy of trees, and there was an opening where you could see through to the sky quite easily and clearly. And this quite large object, let's say like two buses, flew over completely silently and changed to a complete red. And then it receded and went back and went off into the other direction. But it went directly over us as well. So it could have gone anywhere, but it seemed to particularly go right over us. And we're the only people in that stretch of land at that time, most likely anyway. And then after that, we were in a frenzy of discussion and describing it to each other. What did you see? And so on. And after that, I decided to write up a UFO report to a local group called Birmingham UFO Group. And after that, I just decided to read as many UFO books as I could get hold of.
And you, how many friends were with you at the time?
There were three.
And did everybody have the same experience?
Everyone had the same experience, but all the descriptions were slightly different because we were standing from different angles. And it was quite a quick experience. So it was right. Just a flash of this UFO that flew over us. And then because we're best friends, one is brother and one we don't see very often anymore, but we all came to see it as a non-physical thing. So it was more like we described it as sort of a bag of luminescent lights rather than as a structure. There was no particular shape we could define it as because the light was quite powerful. So you couldn't quite see if it was a triangle or a circle. It just seemed to be a whole system of lights. It wasn't it didn't seem mechanical. That was one of the things we all agreed on.
And you said it was silent.
Yeah, it was absolutely silent.
Now, it was your first UFO experience. Did anybody else in the group have a prior experience?
Not that I'm aware of. I had a UFO experience, which is so far back in my memory that I don't usually talk about it in terms of my first UFO experience. Mm-hmm. But I remember one as a kid, about 10 years old, and I ran out into the garden, looked directly up, and there was a triangle in the sky. And I shouted for my mom, and she was taking shopping out of the car. And she thought I was being hysterical, you know, she just ignored me. And I was so insistent that I needed to describe this craft to her, but she didn't believe me. And I became quite indignant as a kid because you couldn't communicate this strange thing in the sky that was only there for a split second and it vanished straight away. It just went completely invisible. But this 2008 is the major sighting where I, because I was 22, and you know, it's when you think back to these younger memories, they're hard to sort of bring up.
Yeah, you know, the reason I ask that question is frequently we've had people who have had that kind of an experience often have an earlier experience when they were young, and it sounds as though you did. Do you in retrospect connect the two at all?
I think so, because although in my 20s I had gone away from being interested in the paranormal and UFOs, and I was more into, say, normal, what you called a conventional literature, although it was, you know, I was getting into existentialism and philosophy, and it was all material and down to earth. And then at that point, it sort of brought back my early sort of childhood interest in the strange and the magical again, which I had as a child. It was always on the outer limits, because I was quite interested in science fiction. And as a kid, one of the films that really affected me was Starman with Jeff Bridges.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that was a classic, and that has a lot of UFO insights in it, where this white light comes down and inhabits the genetics of this past husband and takes over. I mean, that was one of the films I was quite obsessed with as a child. But as I got older, I grew away from a lot of that interest. And that's when it came back again in 2008, when I saw this UFO. It suddenly opened the door again in a much larger way.
Yeah, and you've kind of touched on the idea that you may have had an interest in some other paranormal phenomena as well, beyond just UFO sightings or UFOs. Is that true?
Yes, that was true in my early, you know, when I was about 10 years old up to probably about 14, 15, and then I grew out of it.
So as the door opened again and it opened wider and you took a real interest in pursuing this, and I'm assuming the interest was in one way to try to find some answers, what path did that lead you on?
That led me on a massive trail, because what happened was around about my 20s, I was reading a lot on gloomy philosophy in general, and I had picked up a book by Colin Wilson, who's written nearly 180 books, but his earliest book was on existential philosophy. And I was already a big fan of his work, and I had read all of his early works. And then I had found out he had later on wrote a book on UFOs called Alien Dawn in 1998. And that's when I picked it up. And it linked my interests of the time with these new interests and new developments after the UFO experience. So it was the work of Colin Wilson that brought it all together for me. It was sort of like a massive flash where you could see a landscape, you know, and start to map out a way of new answers. And when I started to read all this UFO literature, paranormal, even the occult, I was interested in the occult with Colin's book on the occult. And then I went on to read Gurdjieff, Blavatsky, and so on. I started to realize that the answer and the mystery of existence, you know, this one of the main drives of my interest in philosophy as a gloomy 20-year-old, started to break away, because you begin to ask so many more questions about the nature of reality, to the afterlife, to how you can affect space and time. I mean, this is the basic underlying recognition of magic. And then you get to the UFO, and if you read a lot of the case studies by John E. Mack, even Jacques Vallée, he links them up with this paranormal dimension, which really caught me on to a lot of other things, because it tied up with all the paranormal phenomena. And then, of course, there's the nuts and bolts interpretation of the UFO, which is usually a craft from another planet, a physical planet, or interdimensional, or then there's the military cover-up. So I became more interested in all that as well. But one of the things I think that really drove it to me was Carl Jung's early work in UFOs, which is Flying Saucers, which was written in 1958. And he saw it as a psychological phenomenon. And at first, I saw it as a psychological phenomenon for myself, because I started asking so many new questions. And that's why I called it evolutionary metaphors, because it was the only way I could grasp the mystery of my own experience at first, because there were no answers forthcoming straight away. And the only one thing I could say it did to me was to open up the door to an enormous range of new literature for me.
Would you say that this quest at this point, and I know we're a long way from getting any definitive answers, but would you say that at this point you're closer to finding answers, or would you say that you have just learned how to ask the right questions?
I think I'm learning how to ask the right questions, and there are echoes of confirmation coming out more and more, because I'd written Evolutionary Metaphors last year, and then a book came out this year, which was released on Oxford University Press, and that confirmed my basic thesis. And in that book, Dr. Pasulka explores very high-flying individuals, such as biotechnologists and NASA officials and so on, who believe in UFOs or have had experiences of other entities. And often they brought up the curious phenomena of synchronicities in their life. So miraculous events would happen in their life, which would lead to technological breakthroughs. And when she was talking about that, I came very close in my own book to this recognition of these entities having some kind of influence over time and space, but also bridging a gap between our world and theirs, and maybe influencing larger echelons higher up in society. But the curious thing I found was that the occult also deals with that, because when people become saturated in the occult world, they look for signs and symbols in reality. And it's, you've got to ask the question, where do these come from? Do they come from the unconscious mind, or do they come from interdimensional spirits? Or extraterrestrial entities or interdimensionals. And it all sort of tied up, because then when you go through my own book, Evolutionary Metaphors, I begin from the ground of the experience, and I focus on Whitley Strieber's works in particular, because I find them quite a reliable psychological insight into the abduction phenomena. And then you lead up to shamanism, which I do in a chapter called Walking Between Worlds, where there are these shamans who undertake altered states of consciousness and commune with spirits and so on. Yeah, and the occult and shamanism bridge over very nicely in abduction literature, because often the abductee is taken aboard a craft and his body is examined, and there's new materials being put into the body. And in shamanism, this is similar. And when the shaman undergoes a sort of initiation, he has visions of being taken by other entities, and his body being worked upon with crystals and things being put into his body. And these seem to be symbolic for his new faculties and so on. And in my own book, I use the example of Credo Mutwa, who's a friend of David Icke, in fact. And he's the head of the Zulus in Africa. And he is a shaman, or a Sansomi, I think they're called. And he relates his own UFO experience in detail, and I've included this in my own book as an example of a shaman who's undergone this experience. And when he undergoes the experience, he comes out with all sorts of psychic faculties, ability to predict the future, heal sickness, have visions for civilization, and so on. So there was definitely a connection, it seemed to me, that between the shaman and the UFO experience.
We, have a lot of people on the program who've had these experiences. And as you said, abductees have a very common story to tell. And frequently it involves some type of manipulation by some type of entity. Why is the story so similar from person to person?
I've always wondered this as well. And I explore this in the book at some length. And it's never quite clear if the physical body's taken or some kind of dream body or astral body is taken, because they always claim in the case studies that it's never not particularly their physical body. And when they have the operations, there are scars on their actual physical bodies, but it's difficult to tell whether this is a form of what would be called stigmata, where the religious mystics have a vision of Jesus and then suddenly find a stigmata on their hands, such as scars and so on of the crucifixion. I was always interested in this, because if something's so psychologically real, it can bridge over into reality, and you can have physical evidence of being abducted. And then there's, of course, the implants, which then suggests that they are being taken, you know, physically and having these things put in. But the bridge is very difficult to put your finger on. When you read more and more, as I did, you come away thinking that this phenomenon is somewhere in between. It's almost they can step into the room and take some aspect of you and work on that without being present. And obviously, with works like Bud Hopkins, he talks about time slips and missing time, missing memories, which come with that. So it seems to suggest that the UFO has some control over time and can control the human mind, which then infers that they either have a form of technology that can pause time or make people lose their memories and put them in exactly the same places. But what it seems to suggest to me is that the entities have kind of occult powers. And it's when I was reading more and more, I found that there were a lot of commonalities between the work of Robert Munro, who used to leave his body. He wrote a book called Journeys Out of the Body. And it's when you start to read things like that, you start to realize that humanity has the powers equal to the aliens in many ways. It's where the aliens represent all of our occult faculties working against us, and we seem powerless. But the more you read, you may realize that we too have their powers, but they're not as well developed yet. So I always thought that they might be evolutionary in the sense that when we look at them, we're actually looking at faculties that we have as well.
When you say evolutionary, are we talking about a psychological evolution? Or are we talking about a spiritual evolution? Or are we talking about a physical evolution?
I think they tie up all together. There's a psychological evolution. I think that's what came for me when I'd seen the UFO, because I had to accept more and more ideas and take them on board to make sense of this bizarre experience that I had, which completely shifted my perspective, because I then had to accept that things weren't being told to us or there were miraculous and strange events that could happen in your life, which scientifically weren't acceptable. And so if you turn to mainstream society, there weren't any answers for it. And then if someone has a afterlife experience or near-death experience, or they have a synchronicity that makes them question time and meaning, or someone has a religious experience, and for them it's very real. It has a real quality. But if they went to mainstream society, there wouldn't be any answers forthcoming for them. So then I think there's a spiritual dimension as well. So the occult obviously deals with ritual magic or understanding time, manipulating time, manipulating meaning, and making things happen in accordance with the mind. And I think as you read more and more ufology, you start to realize that the entities themselves have these powers. And I think if we meet halfway and then read ufology and understand it, and then understand that we aren't passive people, we aren't passive beings, and that we can elevate ourselves spiritually and psychologically, and then accept these other dimensions of reality into our own lives, such as synchronicities, afterlife experiences, and so on, which all seem to be quite convincing the more you read, you start to live in a completely different world or universe, because suddenly it's underlied by a very deep, rich mystery, which I think is lacking in mainstream society, which I think it has a religious base in some ways. It's got a ground of what's lacking in our culture.
Another thing we talk about on this show often is psychic phenomena. And frequently we'll talk to someone who has that sensitivity, and when I ask how it started for them, they'll often cite a near-death experience. Is that a form of this evolution that you're talking about?
Yes, I think it's very much so. And one of the things I've always noticed in reading anything is that people often claim that these miraculous things occur at extreme moments, and there's nothing more extreme than a near-death experience. And I think when they come back to the world in their bodies and they survive this experience, it somehow brings enormous psychic energy into their being, where they grasp life really firmly again, and they know with certainty that there's another level of reality. But they fully appreciate being alive. And I think that's one of the things that brings these psychic faculties to the surface, so to speak. We tend to forget, we fall asleep in the world. And the UFO and any such experience which suggests a deeper reality opens these deeper layers of the psyche up. So it has a psychological and spiritual development that comes with it.
As we talk about UFOs and some of this other related phenomena, and some of what I'm hearing makes me believe that maybe this phenomena behaves by laws that we're not quite familiar with, whether it's the laws of physics or some of the other laws that humanity has come to accept. There's something outside of that I think we're seeing here.
Yes, definitely. One of the things that really fascinates me is synchronicities, because I had a number when I was writing the book and one before it. I'll use one example. I was walking down a street in a town called Stourbridge, and I was talking to my friend about the esoteric philosopher called Rudolf Steiner, and I didn't know anything about him. And his philosophy is called anthroposophy, and it's a strange word anyway.
Yeah.
I said to my friend at the time, I wonder what the fruits are of anthroposophy. I mean, I just meant what the benefits are. Is it any good? Does it have any fruits? I don't know why I used the word fruits, but 10 seconds or a few seconds later, maybe in 1 minute or something, I turned a corner and went into this tiny shop. And it had a very small collection of books in the corner. It was a charity shop. It just said clothes and some secondhand things in there. And there was a book called Fruits of Anthroposophy on the floor. I thought, what are the chances? It completely blew me away. I mean, there was no explanation for it. So I bought it immediately because I thought it must have some meaning if it did. I never really found out what that meaning was, but it was more the event itself for me that blew the doors open. And I think that's one of the ways that the alien or the UFO seems to communicate. There's a lot of strange stories which have this bridge with a symbol. Mike Cleland did a good job of this recently in his book on owls, and he linked up the symbolism of owls and the UFO and the common experience of seeing an owl. Or an owl nearby, this related to seeing a UFO soon. He pushes past the idea that it's a screen memory, that the alien looks a bit like an owl. So to put, when we see an alien, we see an owl because it's the closest approximation that we can get to it. But there seems to be a deeper level than that. And it seems to be that the owl, for him, is symbolic of the death and the other world and the interdimensions, the interdimensional worlds. And also the owl can see more or less 360 degrees. It's at night. It has a radar-like face. It's a very strange creature, and he explores this. And that's what I really appreciate about a lot of these levels that the UFO works on. And evolutionary metaphors is the catch-all phrase that I've put together, which allows you to step back and treat the UFO as if it's an occult symbol, but without denying its reality at the same time.
If these phenomena behave by different laws and they're not the laws of our physical world, are they the laws of a spiritual world or a divine world or an interdimensional world? Or is that the overriding question?
I think that's the overriding question. It's difficult to tell. I would say that the UFO phenomena tends to work in a way, it tends to work in a forward way with a purpose. When you go back to the earliest literature, the question that most people had was, where are they from? Which is what we still ask, but we ask it with a whole new range of other questions now. But when it first happened, let's go back to 1947 with Kenneth Arnold's case. At the time, it was a military phenomenon. And we asked, where are they from and what do they want? What are they doing? And are they military technology? Are they, Russian craft? And then eventually it sort of grew and became more mysterious. Then the abduction cases came in more in the round about the 1970s. One of the best cases I've read is Andreasen Affair by Fowler. And that has UFOs, interruptions in the household, such as electricity going off and the family being in states of hypnosis. And then that's another level of the UFO phenomenon, which wasn't apparently present as early as the 40s. And then it developed into other worlds altogether. The abductions started to grow and become more and more evolved as John Mack started to investigate it. And he was a Harvard psychiatrist, so he grew there into that world of psychiatry and started to understand it. And then there was the more in the 80s again, the crop circle phenomena, and that mysterious circles of flattened wheat and in the farmers' fields and so on. And that added another mystery. And then it seemed to grow and grow, and then it seemed to recede. And again, it's come back again now with the Navy sightings. And that's really interesting as well.
I just wanted to ask you about your website, ritualsinthedark.wordpress.com. What is the significance of Rituals in the Dark?
Ritual in the Dark is the first novel by Colin Wilson. And Colin Wilson's work informs my whole book, which is about optimistic philosophy and the paranormal and the occult.
So Colin's work is obviously instrumental in you kind of turning your attention and your focus from what I guess the rest of us would consider to be accepted school of thought. And you're looking at things completely different because of his work.
Yeah, it was the work that broke down the door for me when I started reading about UFOs and the occult and philosophy. It all sort of flashed with his work because he brought it all together for me. And then Evolutionary Metaphors is how I try to go forward with his work, because he passed away in 2013.
And Philip Dick is another author that plays an important role in how you've gotten to where you are now.
Oh, Philip K. Dick's really excellent work in the latter part of his life with the exegesis, where he was trying to understand an anomaly that happened in his own life with a pink laser beam. And of course, he's most famous for his books, which inspired films like Blade Runner and Total Recall. But his work really informs a part of a very important chapter in Evolutionary Metaphors.
And we just have a couple minutes here, but I want to ask you about religion. We've talked about the occult. Where does religion fit into this, or doesn't it?
I'm not religious myself, but I have quite a bit of respect for the religious impulse, because I think what it brings to people is meaning. And this meaning, I'm talking about more the mystical side of religion than, say, like traditional fundamentalist religion. But there is a curious link between UFOs and religion, because I remember reading a book and it talked about how, you know, the lights were seen by St. Paul and so on, and that it brings about new religions. And this is the concern of the UFO by many. And I think it's a valid one, because it could easily turn into a religion if it carried on.
Your book is available now, and we have another hour to chat. But before we go to break here, where can people get a hold of Evolutionary Metaphors?
You can get it on Amazon.com or Amazon.uk, or you can get it from Sixth Books, which is the publishers. So that's and that's on JohnHuntPublishing.com.
Is there any? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And you can go to Ritual in the Dark, and there's web links on there, which is RitualInTheDark.wordpress.com.
And is there any kind of precursor work that someone would have to do to understand the concepts presented here, or is this fine right out of the blocks?
You can go straight into Evolutionary Metaphors, but I would also recommend Colin Wilson's Alien Dawn, which inspired this, and that's where I begin. But you don't have to read Alien Dawn, because I talk about it at the beginning in my introduction.
We've got another hour with David Moore tonight, and we'll also be taking your phone calls at 844-687-7669. Don't forget that tomorrow night, Scarlett Ravenswood will be on the program, and Bruce the Shark Markison will be sitting in for me tomorrow night. And then Friday is a best-of program. Monday, Del Bigtree, investigative journalist and CEO of Informed Consent Action Network, will be here to discuss his work related to vaccines and pharmaceutical tyranny. So we've got a lot of great programs coming up. Tonight we're talking with David Moore. David is the author of a book called Evolutionary Metaphors, and we're continuing that discussion. And we're also taking your phone calls at 844-687-7669. David, let's talk a little bit about pop culture. Films, books, TV shows, whatever it happens to be. How has that influenced, for better or worse, this what we're talking about here tonight?
I think it's getting better. One of the films I really like was The Arrival, if you've seen this one.
Yeah.
It's a really good one. It's about how the people learn how to speak this alien language. And I think it's done really well, because the The aliens in that film speak in a bizarre way through a sort of pictures on this screen, and I really liked that because it showed you the strangeness of the phenomenon and how it might work if it was speaking from another dimension or another level of experience of time. And I think that's one of the ways that we're going to go. And I think people now want more and more challenging films that show them other realities. And I think with CGI and the computer graphics teams, they can do this. So I'm hoping that that grows and improves.
I think that the film Arrival challenged people because often we think of alien visitors as a bipedal creature, you know, with kind of almost humanoid-like, yeah. and using the same type of communication, although it might be a language we didn't understand right away, but vocalizing their language. And this film really took those ideas and said, no, we've got to think outside of the box. It may not be anything like what we're used to.
Yeah, and I really appreciate when these artistic impressions turn it upside down and inside out and give us insights in just a completely alien way. And I think one of my favorite books is The Miracle Visitors by Ian Watson, which I explore at length in Evolutionary Metaphors. And that book's about the UFO phenomenon. And he approaches it in a way, seeing it as an evolutionary agent, that it comes into reality and it teases us and shocks us and shows us other things. And so it's never quite what it seems. But every time we interpret it, we add a new dimension to it, and it teaches us in a way. It's like a deliberate shock, or what I call what's called a Zen koan. It's usually one of those. It's like in the Zen monasteries, there's always a shock to make you awake and alert. And I think that's what the UFO seems to do as well.
There are people that have been abducted. We've talked about that a little bit, but there are also people that have had visitations from what they consider to be alien creatures. And in some cases, in their bedrooms, and there is a circumstances in which they feel as though this alien creature is keeping them bound in their bed while they're awake. Let's talk about that phenomenon a little bit.
It's a sort of paralysis, isn't it? It comes over the body and they can't move. And these strange insectoid, sometimes insectoid creatures investigate them. And they seem to come in. And say if you're in bed with a partner, she's usually asleep and she has no memory of it. And it seems to be uniquely just the one person. It's rarely the couple that experience it at the same time. Whitley Strieber, for example, I don't think Anne Strieber had any direct encounters, at least as directly as Whitley did, but she was there with them all the time in the same rooms. And this seems to suggest that the alien or the insectoid creatures or whatever they are, these interdimensionals, they can control time and they can pause and choose who to speak to, and they can appear how they like as well. They can appear in whatever form. Their form doesn't seem to be so strictly adhered, but that might as well be a problem of memory, because if we're looking at something truly alien, it's impossible to imagine what it would be to see the alien, what the initial reaction would be. Most likely it would be fear. I mean, you have no expectation for what this being can do and what its purpose is. I think fear would kick in. It would be fundamental fear of the unknown.
We've talked about works of fiction, whether it's film or books, but we also have a very active and robust media, and now social media platforms that are adding, some may call it fuel to these fires, but in some cases they're often ridiculing some of these ideas. How does media play a role in all of this?
I think the media is important to disseminate the idea, and it's usually not a complex one. So the recent UFO sightings by the militaries, the US Navy, has kicked off enormously in the past few weeks. A couple of weeks ago, I think, it blew open and suddenly everyone was sharing UFO articles. And everyone was, you know, they weren't criticizing it by and large because it was quite an official release. I mean, it was the US Navy had seen mysterious objects, and they're an establishment figure and they're reliable. And if they're baffling these high-tech military, that's some cause for concern for people. But people tend to want to see it as nuts and bolts crap, potentially military, potentially physical. But one of the things one of the observers of the phenomena said was that the UFO that he observed seemed to be a sphere, a ball encased in a cube. Now, that's really bizarre description, and it reminds very similarly of some kind of hyperdimensional mathematical or geometrical shape. It's a sphere encased in a cube. It doesn't make any sense. It sounds like a roll cage of some sort, but it seems to be made of light or a plasma as well.
Go ahead and finish.
Okay. Well, it was this way of reporting it, and it was these subtleties that make it very interesting, and it causes this debate to heat up again. And it gives people like me who've written books on UFOs or other people who've written books on UFOs some credibility, some ground to stand on, because then you can point and say, well, the US Navy have officially announced some mysteries going on, so we can talk about it with a level of ground beneath us. When people forget that the forget media's reporting about it, it suddenly fades off into the unbelievable territory, like a fog seems to come over. And it's happened time again. It's not the first time the US military have announced some reality, but we'll see how that unfolds. They might smother it over, or they might bring it back, or it seems to be quite silent at the moment.
Well, there's been a publicly announced change in the position of the US military as far as pilots and other military personnel reporting sightings of such craft or phenomena or whatever it happens to be. Instead of discouraging that reporting, they're actually encouraging it. Is that turning a major corner?
I hope so. And it would be very interesting to see how that develops. Often people are very critical about the government and so on, which is perfectly legitimate. And I think it's perfectly fine to do that, because if you want to, but you've got to be careful, I think, with these things. To what ends are they pulling it out? Is it for good or is it for bad? But I think we may as well be neutral for now and just watch what happens. Be vigilant at the same time and don't buy any immediate announcement and grasp it as absolute truth, because we know that kind of psychological operations that might be at work. And it kicks off with this whole new phenomenon. It's either symptomatic of the age we live in with the political upheavals. It might be used as a political tool at some point, or it could be a symptom of our culture. It's shocking us out, or it's appearing at a moment where we might need it, or it's reminding us of something, or teasing the military. I'm not sure. It's hard to figure out now. It's too early, I think.
You use the word culture. Let's talk a little bit about how all of this affects the culture. Does it affect it significantly, whether it's our culture or maybe a foreign culture? I mean, I'll use, when I say our culture, I mean Western culture versus a different culture that has a different spiritual basis. Does this affect everyone?
I think it does, but it's very hard to detect. But I think it really does inform us, because it comes through our works of fiction, and it's on the liminal. It's on the edge of reality. It's on the edge of what we accept. And I've always been enticed and inspired by that edge, that question, because it appears to me the frontier of the mystery. You know, when you look at the UFO, you're looking at the edge of description, the edge of reality, paranormal. You're right in the field, you know, the borderland. And I think it's in the borderlands where new ideas can grow. So that's why I called it evolutionary metaphors, really. I mean, the phrase came to me before I started writing the book. It stuck. And I thought, there's a lot you can go with this. And it can be described in culture, in stories, in films. And there's always a symbol of something other, something outside of our normal explanations. And I think if it affects our culture, it makes us uncomfortable, and it makes us uncertain about what we know already. And it reminds us that we don't know everything, which is a good thing, because it inspires us to go and find out, to discipline ourselves. I mean, who knows an individual's power to its fullest extent? I mean, that's one of the things that really interests me, is the personal, on a personal level, on my own level, but on individuals and collective cultural levels. Who knows what is possible, what the upper limits and the best possible outcome for humanity is. Is one of the best and most inspiring things about looking into the borderlands and seeing if there is the secret to existence and the secret to having a much richer life is the thing I explore at length in my book as well.
David, earlier in our discussion, you talked about Carl Jung and the fact that he was one of the earliest writers on the phenomena. But, you know, as things have evolved and things change, how would he see it today, do you think?
I think he was very far ahead with his analysis. And I think now he may change his opinion on certain things. He would be very interested in the abduction phenomena, for example, because that hadn't really developed into its fullest depth at the point he was writing Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth Seen in Our Skies, in 1958. I think where he would have gone with it, he would have looked more into technology. He would have incorporated the synchronicity, meaningful coincidences, and he would have been particularly interested in the groundwork, what Pasulka has done recently, that people are getting inspired, apparently, from interdimensional entities, which are forming new technologies. And that's what's interesting, because, of course, there's the famous Roswell crash, and there's a lot of people linking that up with technologies that have been basically hijacked from this craft and being used in everyday life, and probably going so far as our laptops to our screens and all sorts of things. But I think another interpretation of this could be that we're working with a deeper level of reality, and there's some kind of interdimensional force that's inspiring technologists, it may be even artists, to create things. And these are very similar to spirits and spiritualism. So I always think there is a level of reality that where the dead live and, you know, where they continue to live in the afterlife world, and then the alien dimension, then the spiritual dimension, then the gods and goddesses and so on. There does seem to be these levels of reality. And I think he would go more into this direction. But it was hard to say because he was quite critical of spiritualism. But I think he might have become more open with the more grounded work in, you know, sort of holographic realities, and quantum physics would have developed much further. And that's how I think Jung would have gone and where he would have gone if he had lived longer.
I want to get into the connection that you just brought up. And I think that's what you talk about in your chapter called Walking Between Worlds. But before we only have about a minute here before our break, I want to point out something that you just again mentioned. The fact that we've often thought of spirits as being spirits and aliens as being aliens, and even Bigfoot being Bigfoot. And only recently have we started to even accept or at least discuss the notion that they may all be coming from the same place and just be different interpretations of the same phenomena. What do you think of that?
Thomas Holliday in Goblin Universe called it the phantom menagerie, which is like a phantom world where all these creatures exist and shapeshift and become into our reality and take different shapes and forms, influencing us in miraculous new ways. And I think that's what it is. It's like an interdimensional zoo of different things that we don't understand and we're learning to understand.
David, I want to talk a little bit more about the chapter in the book called Walking Between Worlds. There's a connection to the afterlife, shamanism, and more. Let's get into that idea a little bit further.
Oh, yes. Walking Between Worlds was one of the things. I wrote it towards the end of the book, and it was a bit of a breakthrough for me. I just finished reading a book when I began it called Sky Shamans of Mongolia. And I started to see a connection between the occult, UFOs, alien abduction, and it all sort of came together in shamanism. And it's one of the oldest, let's call it a mystical tradition. It's ancient. It goes back thousands of years to the origins, probably, of the earliest man. Even Neanderthal had rituals which seemed to be similar to shamans drawing bison on these cave walls and having maybe ritual magic for hunting purposes. But shamanism is the real base spirituality, and Mongolia particularly, is quite unspoilt in terms of its shamanic tradition. So I looked into that, and I noticed that there was common descriptions of entities, usually in altered states of consciousness, and that's not merely through hallucinogenic drugs, but through ritual dancing and spontaneous visions that they would have. These people were very sensitive. And I looked into the Zulu people, especially Credo Mutwa, who had a very traumatic experience, being, you know, sort of beaten up and taken. And these were by human beings. These were just let's call it the human element that he was traumatized by. And through that experience, he seemed to develop a shamanic capacity. And often it was through trauma. And this is quite an interesting one because Kripal calls it trauma genesis. And often, of course, alien abduction is very traumatic. There's a very terrifying level of abduction phenomena. And this, what I was thinking, is in near-death experiences, there's also that it's not terrifying initially, the near-death experience. It's a sort of letting go. They go into a deeper state and they come back and they integrate. And usually people who have had afterlife experiences seem to have psychic abilities or premonitions. They seem to come back with many of the talents that shamans have, I think. And the shaman too goes into the underworld, into the realm of the dead to speak with that people have passed over. And often, as even UFO abductee cases where the dead arrive with the aliens, their passed over loved ones are with the aliens. So it suggests that they're living in a similar dimension, or at least they have access to the same dimension. And that's a really odd one. And the work of Whitley Strieber, again, which I refer to, his later work was called The Afterlife Revolution. And he talks about the crossover between the dead. He calls them the so-called dead and the aliens. And he, or the visitors, as he calls them, and they have interactions with them through synchronicity, miraculous events. So a car might drive past with the license plate of exactly the kind of word he was thinking of, like a dead dog that he used to have. He popped into his mind, and a car would drive past with the name of the dog on the license plate. Things like that. So it's all ties together very nicely in shamanism because it's the occult, it's magical. They're talking about spirits, extraterrestrial entities, but they have different phrases for the same things that we report and see reported.
As we start to wind down this conversation, you had said your own personal experience in 2008 of seeing a UFO. You described it as, I think you said, a bag of light. That was the description, and you described another sighting in a similar way. You talked about the light, and then we talked about the military sighting where it was a sphere surrounding a cube. As you start to define these and you start to describe these, are we talking about these craft, and I'll use that in quotes, as actually just being an energy, some type of foreign energy that we're seeing and not necessarily anything physical at all?
I think this might be the case. There is examples of the Dorito-shaped UFO. It's very common, a triangle one. And I think I saw one when I was 10 years old. It was just three distinct lights in a triangular form, perfectly still, silent, right above my garden when I was 10. But it's not a clear memory, but I remember being quite disturbed by that. But it didn't linger with me for very long. A few years later, I'd forgotten about it. And then, of course, there's a famous cigar UFO, which I think I have a memory of that, a very brief memory as a child with my best friend at the time. We pointed it out in a perfectly blue sky, so a cigar shape which vanished. And again, it didn't really have much effect on me. It didn't linger. I didn't. Maybe one day after I was playing out again, it didn't scare me. Didn't cause any concern. But then there is the plasma theory, which this seems closer to home at the moment, because I live in Cornwall and there's a lot of famous white lights that are seen out in the countryside around here. They're usually called piskies or fairies. And I've got a friend who took his dog out for a walk and saw a light which he described as a plasmic form arise out of the ground. And there was this vibrating sound, and his dog went into panic. And this is remarkably common in Cornwall, in the southern southwest of England. And we're right out in the sticks. And this is something called Earth Energies theory of UFOs, which they're part of the Earth, or they live in the Earth in some way. So I'm becoming more open to the plasma interpretation. And there's one book called Light Quest, which aims to invoke these lights out of the ground in a sort of occult manner. And that's something I'm looking into because it's very relevant to where I live.
Well, these UFO continue to change form, maybe trick us, maybe find other ways to reach us. I mean, we've seen an evolution so far. Will that continue?
They are very tricky. They have a trickster-like element, which is often talked about. They're like the El Coyote or the Hermes or Mercury. They're wing-footed beings. They play with language, with form, with psychic abilities, and then suddenly they're doing crop circles, and then they're scaring U.S. Navy boats. And they have a very playful, almost playful, and treacherous attitude in some ways. And then suddenly they'll have the transformative elements that you see in the work of Strieber, and then you have the Bud Hopkins cases of terror and body terror. And it's very hard to put your finger on, but I think the important part is to remain vigilant. On the human side, we need to develop our psychical capacities equal to the phenomena so that we can challenge it in some way. And if we can leave our bodies, and if the afterlife experience infers that we're more than what we are, then we've got a lot of ground to be playing with. We're not merely passive or creatures. That these UFOs make us feel small and insignificant and in control, but I think the opposite really is the thing we should be looking at, and empowering ourselves in some way, and looking into the occult and making our lives more integrated, and having this sense of control about this deep reality that we're talking about. I think looking into it is important, and that's why Evolutionary Metaphors was a title for me.
I should have asked this earlier, because you brought up governments, and you know, we've often talked about disclosure and acceptance and acknowledgement, and none of that has happened. Does acknowledgement threaten the governments themselves? Is that why it's been avoided for so long?
I think so, because the whole shift of society would have to turn, and it would kick off, I'm not sure, radical conspiracies, which are perfectly fine for me. I'm not critical of conspiracies at all. But I mean, it would have many effects. And I think it would have a religious effect, political, economical. It would have maybe even cause power political problems and global political tensions, because it would depend on which nation disclosed the UFO. Then Russia would, and then China. There would be the US and then the UK. It would be a chaos, and it would be very hard to put your finger on what that would achieve in a positive sense or even a negative sense. It could complete backlash. But I think one of the things in parapsychology, the study of psychic abilities, is one thing that I have to come first, in my opinion, because there's some, definitely with remote viewing and things like this, is becoming more mainstream. And that's things I'm interested in, is the remote viewing element to the UFO. And I think the UFO will follow suit and follow after these other releases. And I think psychic abilities first, and then UFO disclosure final. I think there's got to be an order to it in some ways.
Where do we go next with all this? Where are the metaphors going?
In my opinion, I've been looking into Colin's work has been very fundamental, but it's also disciplining yourself and allowing yourself to not jump to conclusions. This is one of the things I discipline myself throughout Evolutionary Metaphors, and that's why it's got this title. And I'm not saying they're merely metaphors, they're symbols, they're realities. They're pointing a finger, and we're looking at the finger, but we have to look at the thing it's pointing to. And that's what I'm looking for. I think when we go into the UFO phenomenon, we should accept all of it, all of it simultaneously, but without jumping on conclusions. But what it seems to infer is psychical abilities. And I think these disciplines, if we can learn how to meditate and bring us down into these levels that people who have had near-death experiences have had, And they come back with these messages and these lessons and teachings. And I think we should listen to them and take them seriously and listen to what they have to say. Ibn Alexander is a good example. He uses sound therapies and all sorts of things. And that was like Robert Munro too. And I think that's a way forward. And I think we can come to understand the level that the UFO operates on if we follow all of the different disciplines towards it and sort of converge upon like a pyramid and sort of build up our knowledge of it from the ground up.
I know you're always working, David. Anything in progress that we should be looking out for?
I'm working on a book next on occult psychology called Worlds Together. And I think I'm hoping to bring together UFOs, the occult, and everything I've been talking about in the evolutionary metaphors together and sort of expand on it. The evolutionary metaphors has been my sort of bread and butter, so to speak. It's the groundwork of my where I'm going to be going next. And I explore a lot in that book. There's a lot of different interpretations of the UFO. And I hope that it's a very positive one, because that's what it's intended to be, an uplifting and expansive book.
David, we're out of time. The topic is fascinating. The conversation was excellent. I appreciate your time. Once again, let people know where they can find out more about your work and find the book.
You can buy it from UK Amazon or US Amazon as Evolutionary Metaphors by David J. Moore. Or you can go on my website, which is ritualinthedark.wordpress.com. Or you can go to the publisher's website, which is Sixth Books, which can be found through John Hunt. JohnHuntPublications.com.
Thanks so much for being here, David.
Thank you very much, JV. It's been a pleasure to be on Beyond Reality Radio.
Hey, Jay, you hungry? I just heated up a couple potatoes. Here, let me grab them out of the microwave.
No, JV, don't.
Ah, my thumb! Ah, my thumb!
Presents.
Don't let this happen to you. Krapko's Thumbrella is the perfect protection for the perfect unfinger.
Ah, my thumb!
The Krapko Thumbrella is made up of high-quality heat-resistant asbestos and perfectly suited to handle the most dangerous jobs. Just don't breathe near it.
The Krapko Thumbrella.
Use the Thumbrella for ultimate thumb protection while
using matches,
pouring coffee,
sunbathing near the pool,
changing spark plugs,
handling kill-fired ceramics,
and so much more.
And how about those romantic candlelit dinners?
Come over here, baby.
Watch the candle.
Don't worry, I brought protection. Thanks, Thumbrella.
The Krapko Thumbrella usually sells for $29.95, but call now and we'll triple your order. One for each thumb. And with every order today, Krapko will donate 30 cents to safety. Save a Forgotten Thumb International. The Krapko Thumbrella is the only safety-approved thumb protection device on the market. And isn't your thumb worth it?
The Krapko Thumbrella should not be considered a thumb protection device and is illegal in some states. In fact, most states.
You know, I thought about the Thumbrella because that product by Krapko is actually inspired by a real life event. I actually burned my thumb on a hot bowl that I had used to heat up a potato in the microwave. And the bowl, you know how some dishware should not be in the microwave. It's not safe. It heats up. Mm-hmm. And some, you know, the stuff you actually pay a little money for doesn't do that. So you're safe from being burned. Well, I got burned by the heating the potato thing. And it was a really traumatic experience. It was when the show had first gone syndicated, and I talked about it quite a bit, and people were starting to get a little tired of me talking about the huge blister on my thumb. So that thumb protection device was inspired. Krapko took that idea and ran with it.
Are you sure you weren't using that radioactive Fiesta wear?
No. What's that now?
You never heard about the Fiesta wear? Certain
no.
colors. It was from the 50s or 60s, brightly colored.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Dinnerware, and you run a Geiger counter over it, and it goes off like crazy.
Well, didn't the same thing happen with, they had watches, where they had the, you know, they had the
glow-in-the-dark watches.
Glow-in-the-dark watches had a lot of radiation coming.
Uranium, actually.
Yeah, it's crazy stuff. All right, well, that's going to do it for tonight. Tomorrow, Bruce the Shark Markison will be here talking to Scarlett Ravenswood. It's a great show for you tomorrow night right here on Beyond Reality Radio.
Beyond Reality Radio is hosted by Jason Hawes and J.V. Johnson and produced by Alexandria Johnson and Slick Eddie Edwards for Entercom Radio. Beyond Reality Radio is distributed by Westwood One Radio Networks. Stop by our Facebook page and say hello. Follow the hosts on Facebook as well. For Jason Hawes, follow at jasonhawes.taps. For J.V. Johnson, follow at jvjparanormal. If you'd like to be a guest on Beyond Reality Radio or you have a suggestion for a guest, contact Slick Eddie Edwards at slickeddieedwards@gmail.com. Be sure to visit
visit our chat room as well at beyondrealityradio.com. Thanks for listening.